This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, the trouble with most travel guides is they never tell you about the really cool stuff, like where to find zombies and vampires and death goddesses, stuff like that. Well, now there's the Shambling Guide to New York City. It's a delightful look at the paranormal beings that inhabit the Big Apple, creatures that might go quite unnoticed were it not for Murr Lafferty's new book. The Shambling Guide to New York City is, in fact, a novel that has already helped the author win this year's John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. And she is joining us now to talk about her novel, Murr Lafferty. Welcome to the State of Things.
It's great to be here, Frank.
Tell us about this. Talk about how this story came about, because it is kind of a travel guide to the underworld, the paranormal underworld of New York City. So tell us a little bit about the subject of this novel.
Okay. Well, the subject of this novel is a young travel book editor goes to New York and tries to get a job, and in this economy has trouble doing so, but she finds the perfect job opening, only they tell her, you're not right for this job. And she pursues and pursues and discovers that, well, the people she's writing for are monsters who are traveling to the city, and the people she would be writing with are also monsters. And so she suddenly finds herself working for a vampire who's a publisher with death goddesses and water sprites and zombies on staff. And she has to look at the city in a completely new way, because she has to look at it not from a human tourist point of view, but a paranormal human, paranormal tourist point of view.
Sounds crazy, but most writers can relate to that kind of environment. But
right.
tell me how this story came about, because actually the grist of this novel came about in your own, through your own experience, trying to write a travel guide, right?
Well, it was I was writing a fiction guide, but it was after Katrina. I used to write for role-playing games, and a bunch of independent role-playing game designers, we got together and we like, okay, well, how can we use our skills to help out with this tragedy? And we thought we could write a book that would the money would go to benefit the Red Cross. And so we wrote a book about New Orleans, and I decided to write a look at New Orleans for zombie tourists. And the tour guide who was writing from the first person point of view, the tour guide was a woman who'd been a tour guide, and she became a zombie and loved her job so much she just kept doing it. So I wrote like a 4,000 word story about New Orleans from a zombie's point of view, and where you'd want to stay, what crypts you'd want to sleep in, where you want to go if you get injured, that type of thing.
That's the thing, when you're a zombie, the wanderlust never leaves you.
Exactly. And so I wanted to, the idea stuck with me, and I realized, you know, with that premise, you could take it anywhere. And right. So I thought about doing a New York book, and writing off and on. I had other projects going on too, but I finally finished it a couple of years ago.
What's wonderful about this too is that Zoe Norris, our heroine and protagonist in your novel, is a normal. And so unlike the zombie who's trying to kind of to find the world that other zombies might like, this is somebody who's got to kind of navigate two worlds.
Exactly. It's it was heavily influenced by The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is also about a normal human person going into space, realizing he has to write a travel guide. And the really embarrassing thing is, I've been a fan of Douglas Adams for the past 25 or 30 years, but I never actually realized that it influenced me until I was done with it and looked at it and went, oh, right. That book had a big impact on me, I guess.
So but long, and thanks for all the fish.
Exactly.
Well, maybe you can read for us from your new novel.
Sure. The store didn't win her over with its stock. She'd never heard of most of the books. They had titles like How to Make Love, Marry, Devour, and Inherit in 8 weeks in the romance section, and When Your Hound from Hell Outgrows His House and Yours in the pet section. She picked the one about the hounds up and opened it to chapter 4, The Aegean Stables, How to Pooper Scoop Dung That Could Drown a Terrier. She frowned. So they're really assuming your dog gets bigger than a house? It's not tongue-in-cheek? If this is humor, it's failing. Despite the humorous title, the front cover had a frightening drawing of a hulking white beast with red eyes. The cover was growing uncomfortably warm, and the leather had a sticky, alien feeling, not like cow or even snake leather. She switched the book to her left hand and wiped her right on her beige sweater. She immediately regretted it. One sweater ruined, she muttered, looking at the grainy black smear. What is this stuff?
Mer Lafferty, reading from her new novel, The Shambling Guide to New York City. When you do this, and you have written science fiction fantasy before, this is what you prefer to write, right?
Yes.
This is your stuff. So how much of New York City do you have to know? Do you have to do you do a lot of research for a book like this?
Well, I've been a couple of times, but honestly, with the internet and with travel guides, and I have several friends who live there, I was able to do a lot of research remotely. And considering that, you know, I'm writing a book about somebody who writes a travel guide, travel guides are actually a very a legitimate way to research the city. So I wished I could have gone up there more, but I was unable to.
And the characters in your book, I mean, and to some extent, again, anybody who's traveled has sort of wondered at one point or another if there isn't some kind of whole paranormal level that doesn't go on in this city, if it's exotic to you. Are these characters who you've seen, or are they sort of the stuff of fantasy and games, you know, sort of video games that populate this novel?
Well, it's a little bit of both. You know, I've been to I grew up in a very small town in North Carolina and lived in Durham for the past several years, but I never really got a sense of living in a city. And I've always been fascinated by it. But also, I do have these small town girl, wide-eyed, oh, God, I'm going to get lost or shanked or something. And, you know, I've been, you know, I'll turn the wrong corner and immediately not know where I am, that thing. So I have a wide-eyed view of the city. And also, I've been on the subway and seen people that, you know, you wish that if you were in a completely safe area, you'd like to interview them and ask them who they are and why they're acting the way they're acting. But right. You know, it might be dangerous to do so. I've seen some people that I thought, well, you know, you could be normal or you could be a vampire. I'm not really sure. So it's always fun. But, you know, my reading and urban fantasy and science fiction and other things also contribute to it. Mythology, folklore, things like that.
Well, the wonderful thing about this book, and I think a kind of subtext, is the way we do adjust to something that our upbringing, right, and our experience, it's totally exotic to our experience. And yet here it is in front of me. So we make this adjustment as humans and try to fit it into some kind of normal frame. I mean, I sort of love that. And that's what this book does. Poor Zoe is just having to make this stuff feel normal because there it is.
Right, right. It's I've always, when books try to show people suddenly becoming aware of the magical or monstrous world around them, oftentimes I think they accept it a little too quickly, when naturally we would try to figure out any possible explanation that is not "this is magic" or right, whatever. And so I tried to make her acceptance of the world a little slower because of that.
Well, maybe you can read another passage that makes reference to our beloved triangle, and you can set this up for us. And I think this also illustrates kind of Zoe's as she's being brought deeper and deeper into this world.
Sure. They are, she has convinced the publisher to meet with her, and he's taking her out to dinner at a specific restaurant that he enjoys. And she's looking at the people all around her and realizing that none of them look quite human. And of course, her mind decides to think that they're cosplayers, which are people who go to science fiction and fantasy conventions and dress up as their favorite monster or anime character or whatever. And he's completely flummoxed because he did not expect that reaction. And so he allows her to keep thinking that they're just dressing up. And so he starts to, let's talk about your book, because she did work previously at a travel guide publisher in Raleigh. He perused the book on Raleigh, nodding in some areas and frowning in others. Zoe pointed out her specific work, whether it had been editing or writing, and he read in silence for several minutes. Their wine arrived without further comment from the zombie, and she sipped her red and tried not to fret. Phil closed the book and handed it back to her. I'll be frank. You are nearly perfect for the job, and it bodes well that you are not put off by the various customers we hope to reach. But I admit I haven't been 100% honest with you. At that point, time seemed to slow for Zoe. Four waiters had gathered around the table where the three burly men sat after devouring their meat. Two were dressed as zombies, one was much cleaner, and his fangs indicated he was probably a vampire, and the fourth had some superb scaly makeup covering his face and hands. They all began to sing happy birthday to one of the men, who beamed and didn't bother to wipe the juice from the steak off his face. A fifth waiter approached from the kitchen, this one stuck on demon horns, carrying he carried... Zoe swooned for a moment, a memory hitting her like a fist to the jaw. When her family had moved to the suburbs of North Carolina, she would often ride her bike around the development. During one mid-morning Sunday ride, she came across a scene that took her brain a full 10 seconds to process. Nothing she saw was otherworldly, but it was so out of place in a peaceful suburb that she refused to see it. A family stood in the backyard, watching a man butcher a deer they'd hung on their kid's swing set. The skin lay in a discarded pile to the side, and the man approached the pink muscles and sinew and started to carve off hunks of venison with a long knife. Zoe stopped and stared, and her brain attempted again to process, but it failed. They're slaughtering a deer. A deer. In the suburbs. A skinless deer is hanging right there.
Mer Lafferty. Her novel is The Shambling Guide to New York City. A great scene. And again, somebody who's having to kind of put this all in place. And a scene that you actually saw, right?
Yeah. I live in a suburb of Durham, and this is several, maybe 11, 12 years ago. We were driving to breakfast on Sunday morning and came to a stop sign and saw directly into a family's backyard, and there was a swing set hanging there with something hanging from it. And I had stopped at the stop sign, and I wasn't going, and I didn't register it, and my husband didn't register it, and we just stared. And a couple of seconds went, and he's like, "We need to go now," because there was a skinless deer hanging there. And the family was all standing around watching Dad butcher the deer. And it was, you know, I grew up in the mountains, but this was not something I'd ever seen before. And the shock just made me take a couple of seconds to process.
Which is what our friend Zoe does as she sort of makes her way through this entire novel. You use something called the magic spreadsheet to help you write. Tell us about it.
Well, the magic spreadsheet is simply a Google spreadsheet that my friend Tony came up with. He used to do, or rather he does, CrossFit and decided to make a point system to give him incentive. So really the goal was to, the goal is consistency, not necessarily thousands of words a day, but as long as you write every day, then you get points. And I've been a freelance writer for 10, 11 years, and only in this past year has something given me the incentive to write every single day, which I've done for the past 303 days, which is watching these points pile up and watching the chain continue to go. And I don't want to break my chain for anything. And for some reason, that's why I called it magic. I told him it was a magic spreadsheet because nothing had ever made me write every day except for this spreadsheet.
And CrossFit is kind of, this is a training program, right?
Right.
It's an exercise program.
Right.
And so that's, you know, getting people, you know, on their feet and exercising every day has the same impulse. So it's fascinating. I mean, you're really sort of working on these tricks of the mind, the way we make all of these adjustments. I'm a writer. I want to write. I want to be successful. That should be enough. No, it takes the magic spreadsheet
Yes.
to really get me to do this thing.
Yeah, it's really silly, but also one of the key points of the magic spreadsheet is you don't have to write a lot. You have to write 250 words, which is essentially a page. And I've discovered that if it is late at night, if I've been sick, if I've been upset, I can still squeeze out 250 words. They may not be good words. Mm-hmm. I've even written while falling asleep, and those are some pretty strange words that I don't keep, but I've written every single day.
Have you ever found that you go back to some of those words that you were just doing to rack up the points? You really knew this is a complete fraud, Mer, none of these words are worth a thing, and gone back and find out that in fact they were?
Oh, often.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was, Tony built this in part because of the writer Cory Doctorow, who said he's a multi-published author, he's New York Times bestseller, but his goal is to write 250 words a day. And, you know, if you write 250 words a day, you'll get a novel in a year. And sometimes he writes more, but, you know, it was his goal, just this little bit. And one thing he told me was, if you write, you know, when you write every day and you look back on your book, you can't tell which day was the one where everything just flowed and everything was on and which day was horrible and like pulling teeth. It's just, you know, it all blends together.
Can you tell anything about your process looking back over those documents?
What do you
mean? Good days, bad days, things that were going on that day that turned out a nice page versus stuff that was...
Well, I'm going for my MFA in popular fiction, and it's a low residency program, so every 6 months I go up to Maine for 10 days and have a very intensive residency. And I remember the scenes I was writing during that time I was in Maine, and I was working very hard all day and exhausted at night. And I remember that scene took a lot of editing, I have to admit, yeah. when I got back. So the days when I do try to get my words done before 10 p.m.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting. Just the process itself can over time maybe even streamline your writing process.
Right.
So now this novel is going to be part of a series, right?
Right.
What's next?
The next one is I decided to go back to New Orleans, and it's called Ghost Train to New Orleans, where Zoe and her team get on the very first ghost bullet train to go from New York City to New Orleans, and they go down there and try to figure out how best to write a book about New Orleans. And, of course, many things go wrong on the way.
We will look forward to it and have you back. Myrrh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Myrrh Lafferty is the author of The Shambling Guide to New York City, and she is this year's John W. Campbell Award winner for Best New Writer. For more information about the book and about Myrrh, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you for listening. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.